Now, if you're disconnected from your body, that means you're going to be disconnected from yourself as well, because your body gives you so much rich information that you're missing. So it would be like watching a movie without understanding the language, for example. You get the general gist, but once you get the subtitle, you're like, oh, this is what it is.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Purple Stars podcast. I'm Sarah, your host, and I am so thrilled to tell you we have the millennial therapist on the show today. She's a psychotherapist, speaker, author, and above all, she's a wise and very kind soul. Please welcome Dr. Sarah Kuberick.
Aw, thank you. That was such a kind introduction. I am honored to be here.
I'm so excited to have you on the show. It's taken a little bit of time, which was also my fault. And I do want to bring that up because it's actually a question I want to add to our conversation. Mm-hmm. Because, so I, just for the audience, I messed up the dates because our interview would have been scheduled for yesterday. And while I was prepping for today and getting ready, I was thinking to myself, it's so interesting because so many people, when they mess up something or when they actually don't want to attend, they come up with all sorts of excuses. Mm-hmm. So rather than saying it was my fault, a lot of people say, oh, my PA messed it up. Yeah. Or if there is a friends gathering, rather than admitting, oh, my batteries are low, I can't socialize today, they would say, I have so much work to catch up on. And I wonder, what are your thoughts on that? Because I find it personally very liberating when I do share the truth rather than being having to be creative about the excuses.
No, absolutely. I think we treat each other like we're so fragile, and you know, I don't think we're as fragile as we think it is, and what ends up happening is a culture of dishonesty. And I think if we say things with kindness, it's going to be okay. And I think I had a, I mean, I'm, you know, Eastern European, so they tend to be a little more direct. And I love my dad. My dad is the kindest human. But one time my sister and I invited him over to come to our house. We haven't seen him in like 2 weeks. We're like, hey, dad, like, do you want to swing by? Like, we'll make you lunch, just like catch up. And he goes, and this is the best. He's like, you know, I could, but I just don't want to. And, you know, we're so close that it didn't like offend me. I think for him, it was like, I'm so tired. It's the weekend. I need to sleep. And then he was like, but let's do this and this. Miss you girls. Love you. Whatever. And I was like, imagine a parent saying that. I think for a lot of people, they're like shocked. But I think because we're so close and because he wanted to teach us honesty and he wanted us to teach us like boundaries, you know, I'm exhausted. I need some rest. I need sleep. I need alone time. And we were adults at this point. And I like really, really appreciated that. So my dad's always kind of been a role model of like saying things really kindly, but not lying, just being really, really authentic.
What do you think is the limiting belief behind the creative coming up with excuses behavior in our society?
I think it's twofold. I think one is that the other person can't handle the truth. Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting limiting belief that we have. And then the other one is if we don't do exactly what people want us to do, they're not going to like us. So it's like, it's a very, I must fit the mold. I must do everything I'm asked to do or pressured to do. Otherwise I'm going to lose everyone that loves me. And that's a, you know, a scarcity mindset that a lot of us have adopted. I mean,
what do you think helps people to move from the scarcity mindset to actually an abundant and freedom mindset? Because the truth is, if someone ends her friendship with us because we're not showing up for a gathering and saying, hey, my batteries are so low, then actually thumbs up that this person is out of your life.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, it's easy for me to say because I'm an introvert. I don't need that many people in my life. I don't have the capacity for that many close people in my life, and I'm okay with that. But if you are someone who would take offense, that means you're not someone that would be very close to me, which then probably just means you're not someone who's very relevant in my life. And so it is kind of almost like a sifting process of if I can't be my true self, and again, I'm being respectful, I'm being kind, I'm not being flaky or bailing last minute to really important things. But if I can't be authentic, then that's a really good sign that you probably shouldn't be in my life, or at least not in a very intimate capacity.
Given the big expertise you have on relationship, let's talk a little bit more about friendships. What is, in your opinion, a sign of a healthy friendship? Because there's so much psychological research how important healthy friendships and relationships are to our longevity, also to our well-being. And I see that a lot of people are, without labeling, they are overly tolerant when it comes to their friends' behavior.
I think we're overly tolerant when it comes to our partners' behaviors too.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm sad how deprioritized friendships are. And I've heard it explained this way in terms of like your romantic relationship is the main story and your friendships are the supporting characters. And I don't think that that's necessarily healthy. I think friendships are incredibly important, and that's why we should look out for those green flags and red flags. And the reason I bring this up is because I think they're the same as in a romantic relationship. Do they say what they're going, like, do they do what they said they would do? Do they treat you with respect? Are they honest with you? Do they create a safe space for vulnerability? Can they, I don't know, make you laugh? Do they accept your flaws as well as your strengths? Like it's really limitless, but all of them can apply to literally any relationship.
What I think is also for me always a great parameter is how does this connection make me feel? And I'm not talking
Oh,
about
yes.
one situation, but overall. Like out of 10 situations, is it making me 50% good or only 20% good? Because I see this with a lot of my clients. They say, oh, this person, it makes me not feel good, but this is because of their childhood, and this is because of that. They come up with all sorts of excuses. I love how your facial expression. I hope people are watching this on YouTube. Because, and I always say, no, you are making excuses, so you have an excuse for still keeping the person in your life. And
Absolutely.
an explain it's an explanation, but it is not an excuse. And I think it's very important to make a difference between those two. What do you think? Why is it with also, of course, with romantic relationships, but especially with friendships, to when the time has passed to actually end them? Because with a romantic relationship, often we live together, we pack our stuff, or they pack their stuff, and it's easier to kind of close the chapter. With friends, we don't really have this conversation or rarely ever sit down and say, hey, we're breaking up. It just they fizzle it out, and then like people don't call back anymore, or they make excuses why they don't want to see you, and then just hoping that it somehow ends without having that conversation. And I actually think that this does way more harm than good if we don't sit people down and say, hey, that's how I feel. How do you feel about it?
No, absolutely. Before I answer that question, I do want to just, I love what you said when you were like, I want to know how do I feel around this person? Not once, but over time. I think that is one of the most telling things ever about any relationship, and I hope that people truly clock that. The only other thing I would add that sparked, like your comment sparked this thought was, do not surround yourself with people who you do not want to be like. If I start to notice that you're exhibiting patterns and behaviors and ways of functioning that I do not align with or I do not want to have, I need to distance myself because you do become who you hang out with. This is a cliche saying, but it's true. And so I think that that's a really good evaluation of like, hey, they're starting to exhibit behaviors and becoming a type of person I don't want to become. This is a deal breaker. I just wanted to add that.
This is so good what you just said, because it's so often that, and I'm not, just to clarify also for the audience, we're not talking about, okay, what kind of job they have and all sorts of like when it comes
fashion
to like the
choices.
Surface, exactly, not the fashion choice, but the core beliefs. What is their North Star and how do they operate when no one is watching? I think that's really what we are talking about. And how do you deal as a psychotherapist when you have friends? I know you're an introvert, but I guess you probably do have a certain amount of friends. How do you deal with situations when you clearly see them going with the bicycle without a helmet against a wall? And how do you, where is the line that you're saying, I want to distance myself, and where is the line of saying, I need to be different to be supportive? Very good example. We all have this one friend who is in a relationship with someone that's clearly not good for her or him. And I'm just throwing in the word narcissist. How do you as a psychotherapist deal with that situation?
Well, I mean, I think there's different stages of like support, stages of trying to offer some piece of advice. And sometimes I'll joke and be like, you know, people pay for this and you're getting it for free and you're not listening. I mean, obviously it's a joke. My friends should not take me seriously as a psychotherapist in terms of I'm not their therapist and I'm a lot more blunt and I'm obviously not as objective because they're my friend and I'm protective. So it's a completely different dynamic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you do try to give some guidance or some advice if you have it. And there's only been one situation ever where a really close friend kept making really destructive decisions. Where I had to, and I had, leading back to your conversation, a really clear conversation where we sat down and I went, look, if you keep living your life this way, I am not going to be a part of it because it's starting to hurt me watching you hurt yourself. I cannot do that anymore. I've done it for years. It's starting to impact my mental health. I love you. I'm here for you. If you want to change, call me up day or night. If you want to keep living the life you're living, this friendship needs to end now. And that is a conversation that I had. I made sure she had a support system that was there for her when I did it. But for me, it was just very much like, it was the only breakup I've ever had with a friend. And that was after years of trying to be that support and then just being like, I can't do this anymore. I'm not effective. And so here is my boundary. And then I had a very legitimate breakup.
This shows so much strength and also courage because so many people hang out with people that drain them. Sometimes even they hang out with people they don't even like.
That's true. I know. I hear this all the time. You don't even like this person. Why are you hanging out with them?
Yeah. Why are you even hanging with them? Yeah. It's so... I love how we're so alike when it comes to these kind of reactions.
It's great. This is great.
Sarah, so maybe we wrap up the chapter of friendships. Tune in, feel, how does this relationship make you feel? Overall, not on a single occasion, but overall. And what Sarah also said, like, closely observe their values and are these values you want for your life or not? And I think it's very important to know this is your life and you can hire and fire accordingly, how they say. And that's just very important to know and also to keep reminding yourself no matter what other people are doing.
Yeah, I think it, regardless if it's a familial relationship, a friendship, a romantic relationship, so many of our actions are driven for the other and by the other. And it's not about being selfish or egocentrical because I think there is a lot of pop psychology messaging that's quite individualistic. And I think that can also become really extreme. But I think you need to realize that this is your life. This is not anyone else's life. And the decisions you make have to be for you. It doesn't mean you have to be a selfish person, but people who are really around you, You know, there's examples of individuals who will marry someone because all their girlfriends are like, but he's so great. He makes this much money. He's good looking, comes from a good family. Oh my God, you're so lucky. You should definitely marry him. Great. So she marries this dude, and now she goes home every day to someone she has nothing in common with, finds incredibly boring, hates all his habits, or someone she doesn't want to have sex with because she's not attracted to them, even though he's maybe an objectively attractive person. And so what happens is you made this decision for and by with everyone, and yet now you're the only one living with the consequences. And that's what I want to point out. Stop making decisions based on purely external factors because you're the only person that's going to feel the consequences to the deepest extent of your own actions. And so to me, I mean, there are some exceptions to that, but to me, it's just so important to make sure it works for you. So a friendship, a relationship, a family dynamic, whatever it is.
You are also an expert in somatic exercises, I saw online. And I'm wondering, could you maybe share for people what somatic exercises are and also what's different to traditional, exercising? And maybe are there some exercises that they can do to release the fear of living life on their own terms?
So I'm an existential psychotherapist, so that's my specialty. And then I also love somatic. And the reason I fell in love with somatic is when I went to therapy for the first time, my therapist did a lot of somatic work for me. And I was so disengaged and disconnected from my own body that I had no idea what was happening. Now, if you're disconnected from your body, that means you're going to be disconnected from yourself as well, because your body gives you so much rich information that you're missing. So it would be like watching a movie without understanding the language, for example. You get the general gist, but once you get the subtitle, you're like, oh, this is what it is. And that's what that was like for me. So a lot of the exercises that I've done with her and that I do with my clients is, it is a lot of releasing through your body. So let's say that you can do it either way. So you can ask a client to think about a particular memory and then to start to scan their body. It's a really basic introduction. Start to scan their body to see where the tension or a sensation or a tingling is, or has their breathing changed, and just understanding where it's stored, where it's processed, where it's being triggered within your body. You can also just scan your body with no prompt, and a client will be like, or I used to do this, I used to be like, oh, you know, my hands feel weird. And then she would go, okay, what memory comes to mind when you think about your hands? And every time, for example, for me, when I would have a memory connected to my hands or arms, it was a relational memory. And it's beautiful and it's wonderful, and it's really just a way to make sure that your body is coming to the conversation, and that through your body, she would do releases on me as well, in terms of you would just start shaking. I would start shaking, and I don't know if you've ever experienced, I used to experience this all the time and I just didn't know what it was. When you're like really stressed or anxious about something, you'll just feel like your body's like shaking or releasing, and you're just like, what is happening? I used to be like, am I cold? Like, all of a sudden, you kind of feel cold almost, and you're shaking. And then I realized that that was my way of my body releasing things. And I would sit there, and my body would just release for 2, 3 minutes. And it felt really strange because your body would do the weirdest sort of movements. And it was really, really cool to comfort and be there for my body that way.
I really want to point out how amazing the metaphor is watching a movie without understanding the language. And then reading the subtitles, you're like, holy cow, that's what my body wanted to tell me all along. So I wanted to say it's interesting that you said about the shaking, because when you look in nature and animals, a polar bear naturally is shaking after a fight or anything that's kind of needed a lot of adrenaline and cortisol, and that's their natural way of balancing their nervous system. So that's also why our bodies then sometimes shake as a way of balancing the nervous system. It's also with dogs. They often shake themselves to de-stress. And I love how you said with how you feel in your hands and in your arms, because in Chinese medicine, especially, every single body part is related to an emotion, is related to something physical, something mental. And it's so beautiful to see when we include our body in the self-growth journey, how much more whole we feel. Because very often I see this with personal growth, whether it's therapy or going to a workout or having someone that does tapping with you, whatever it is, very often they only have one outlet that they are using. And we are body, mind, and soul. And in order for us to feel whole and in order for us to feel at home, we need it all. So I love that you are huge fan of somatic exercises and also included in your on your journey.
I think it's really important to integrate the holistic approaches, like whatever your specialization is. It's knowing how to tap into the person holistically, because that's how they experience their life. And I think that that's sometimes the biggest misdirection when it comes to healing that we give people, is like, just pay attention to your thoughts or just pay attention to your body. And I just want to be like, don't do any of those. Just do all of it. Like, don't just isolate. And I, you know, you are so much wiser and more complicated than you think.
It's so true. And I love also how you say you're so much more complicated than you think. It's so true.
You know, we reduce ourselves by trying to oversimplify what's happening for us. And I think sometimes that's not really fair, because you are more complicated than your explanation, always.
Yeah. And the truth is, I always say, as long as we're here, there's something to discover. Because if there, I really have this belief, we're not here anymore. Like, our life will end if there's nothing else to discover. So I see it as a privilege that I have something to discover about myself, because this means I, you know, like, I'm here and this is my journey still really going on. And just recently, because you're talking about your body, I was reflecting a lot on my 20s. So I'm now 31, and I thought, what were some of the biggest lessons I have learned in the 20s? And obviously, as you know yourself, the 20s are full of question marks and lots of different answers. But I would say the biggest learning for me was building a healthy relationship with my body. That was really my biggest learning, because in my early 20s, I remember 2021, I was counting calories. I was like punishing myself for workout when I had like a dessert the evening before. I wanted to like look good. Whatever was on the scale really determined how I felt that day. So it was, you know, like I was following all these diets, not primarily to lose weight, but you know, when there was keto and gluten-free and this and that.
The fat.
And but over time, I fortunately, also for my coaching, I found a way to intuitively nourish my body and also to take care of my needs. And that's why I was so excited when I found out that in your book, you have an entire chapter dedicated to our bodies. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was actually my favorite chapter to write, which is shocking to me, because I was sitting there and there were a couple of chapters in the book, The Body Included, where I was like, everyone talks about this. How do I make sure that there's something unique about it? Or how do I make sure that I speak my truth through it without, you know, repeating what's been said? And what that did for me is it forced me to go back to my 20s with my relationship with my body. And that was really important, because my body and I didn't have a relationship in my 20s. And then I got to ask myself, well, why didn't I have a relationship with my 20s? And that started this really cool exploration that then ended up being in the chapter. Because I think I used to have the thought that I owned my body. So my body was a tool, it was a vessel, and it was kind of like a servant. And it did not require my appreciation, my gratitude. All it required was for me to punish it, yell at it, critique it when it did something wrong. So, very similar to how when your food comes out on time, no one's like, wow, my waiter's amazing. They just go, my waiter's doing what they're supposed to do, right? Like that's kind of the, which by the way, we should be nicer to waiters. But and then when they do something wrong is when we acknowledge their presence. It is only when they do something wrong that we truly acknowledge their presence. And that was me with my body. And so I think, you know, it really got me thinking about existentialism, and I talked a lot about what is just our belief around it. And until I realized that my body was not just what I had, but who I was, I didn't have a healthy relationship with it. Until I realized that my body was so much smarter than I was in so many contexts and gave me incredibly life-saving signals, I didn't start to respect it. And so it was a long journey of reframing really limiting and unhealthy beliefs that my body wasn't safe, that my body wasn't for me, that my body was a project, all of these beliefs. And then by slowly starting to pay attention to it, acknowledge it, and kind of build that closeness with it over time.
What do you think has helped you the most? And I'm sure it's like an accumulation of a lot of things because the 20s are long. But if you could say your core, what was in the core the most important for you on your journey to see your body not as a something you own or something that you're disconnected with, but actually something that you call your home.
So in my early 20s, I developed a panic disorder that lasted a couple years. And that was the first time I faced my body because I've ignored it until it became so loud that I couldn't ignore it anymore. And the way it became so loud was giving me my very first panic attack. And I remember hating it so much when that happened. And I remember being so scared of it because I realized I had zero control over my panic attacks. I couldn't think my way out of them, I couldn't ensure my body didn't have them. And I realized how much power my body had. And that was like a wake-up call, and not necessarily a positive one, but it was a wake-up call that I'm dealing with something really wise and powerful and autonomous also, that I am not just dealing with this submissive thing that I get to mistreat and do whatever to. And then it took maybe a year or two to realize that that panic attack saved my life, that the messaging you wanted to get across wasn't a way to make me submissive or to punish me or to control me. It was actually to save me. It was trying to give me a message that I've been cognitively denying for so long that this was the last resort. And it was the thing that prevented me, my life from going in a very, very wrong direction. And so I look back, I guess when I realized the loving gesture that it did, when I realized that it saved my life, that's when that relationship fully changed. So we hit rock bottom together and then we kind of soared together. And now it's something that I am very, very attuned and sensitive to.
What message did your body hold for you during that first panic attack, now looking back?
I remember distinctly thinking, I'm going to die without ever having lived. And what I mean by that is, I was living the quote unquote perfect life in terms of I was doing it right. Like I was that annoying, overachieving, you know, fit, long-term relationship, like girl that was a TA for every professor, that was a this, that was that, you know. And I was helping the community and I was becoming a psych and all these wonderful things. And I've never hated myself more, ever. And I think it was telling me, you can't keep living like this because you're existentially killing yourself. There's only so much more you can convince yourself that you want this. It's only so much more that you can live such an inauthentic life without feeling the consequences. And I'm not saying anything objectively that I did was bad. It just wasn't my choice. I just, it wasn't authentic. It wasn't aligned. It wasn't, I didn't even make it conscious. I just did it because it was the thing to do. And the only thing in that life that remained after I blew it up and made all the changes was psychology, because that was the only authentic thing that was in my life at that time. And so it was kind of a warning, and it was saying, you're not happy and you're not living the life you want, and I don't think you're going to survive doing it for much longer.
What happened afterwards?
So panic attack, great. I had to get off a flight, had the paramedics come. I went into full paralysis. Eventually they gave me medication, went away. And then I went back to my life, and I was like, you know what? I got this. But, like, I was like, okay, this is saying something, and I should go to therapy so I can fix my response to my life. But at no point was I like, I need to fix my life.
My life.
Because I didn't understand how I could possibly be doing something wrong. I'm the girl that does it right. I checked off the boxes. It didn't even cross my mind that I was doing something wrong. I was like, something's wrong with my body, so I just need to train it to be okay with my life. And that's when I started therapy. And that's when I started to realize, like, oh, this is something I've convinced myself that I've wanted for so long, and I actually don't want it at all. And I am not even in here. I don't even know who I am. And I then spiraled hard. So, you know, people are like, my panic attack was my rock bottom. Yeah, and then I realized there was more depth and more bottoms to hit. And I think the truths and the traumas I had to face from my childhood, and just the truths of how I participated in my own suffering, that was the hardest part. No one forced me to do these things. They encouraged, they rewarded, but I decided to create the life that I had. So if it was anyone's fault, or if it was anyone's mistake, or if it was anyone's responsibility, it was mine. And that was such a hard pill to swallow, that I was hurting myself by the way that I was, you know, living my life. And so it was years and years of just unraveling and then slowly changing. And I think for me, I kind of had to deconstruct fully before I could reconstruct. And so it took a while. It wasn't like a quick thing that I just did in like a month of therapy and was like, great. It was years of literally changing my life.
And do you remember a time where you sat down and you felt, wow, now I actually feel aligned with what I'm doing, and I feel that my choices are very authentic?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, there were moments of it, but I think when I started to get the feedback of like, you seem like a very different person now. And when I started to feel like a very different person was probably during COVID, ironically. I mean, obviously, you know, I was on that path for a really long time. But then I think while everyone else was having a crisis during COVID, I have never felt more embodied or grounded, or, and that was a weird intersection of a lot of things in my life happening at the same time. But I remember just sitting there and watching life kind of for everyone crumble, and then feeling incredibly safe and rooted in myself. And that was an interesting experience of like, I actually am very content with my life, even though these things are hard, even though I'm scared for my family and friends, even though I'm worried about all my clients, even though I'm worried about the world. Having this like inner strength and inner pillar, I think that really was really salient at that moment. So maybe it was present even before, but it just came, it was very highlighted during the global crisis.
I love how you call it inner pillar, because I think our happiness, our joy, our success, also our misery, depends if we have it or not, is so dependent on this inner pillar. It's so much because, and other people might call it being grounded, having like strong roots, or having a strong intuition or a strong belief in life. It doesn't matter how you call it, but I do think if we are not building that resilience and that we have this like feeling home within ourselves and believing in our ability to face whatever is out there, and that also life is our friend, life gets really tough. And especially when things are tough on the outside, it gets even tougher because we have nothing to fall back onto. What do you suggest to people who are in the, because you said earlier you contributed a lot to your own misery. What advice do you have for people who are living in victimhood and contribute a lot to their own misery, whether they're conscious of it or not?
Yeah. The first one's a hard truth, which is nothing will change until you do. And you won't become an autonomous and free human as long as you keep playing the victim. And this is not to say that sometimes we're not victim to life. Of course we are. But do I think that sometimes we take on that role when it's really not our role? And do we hide behind that role? I do. And so I think either you're doing it consciously or super unconsciously. I don't want you to be the victim, not because that's bad. I just don't want you to be the victim because that's not fulfilling. Mm-hmm. I want you to have a really fulfilling life. I want you to feel autonomous and free and courageous and empowered. And I want you to play with life. Life is so interesting. It's like you get a blob of clay and then you get to decide what you want to do. And then other people will come and poke at it. And you're like, okay, that kind of ruined the shape. How do I work around it? How do I still make it into that mug I was hoping to have at the end of the process? Or maybe you're like, I don't want the mug anymore. Now I want a bowl. The point is, I really want you to see life as something that's yours and something that's even fun, may I say, like, and absurd and kind of pointless, but also meaningful in the best ways. And I just don't think that you can have those feelings and that excitement and that vitality and that courageousness if you feel like you're powerless. And that's what victimhood does. It takes away your power. And I always want people to feel power because it does belong to you.
I want people to really let this sink in because it's so empowering what you just said. Like, it's our life, we own it, and it's supposed to be fun. And it's supposed to be full of joy and fulfilling and full of color. And of course, a day-to-day life might not always be the most fun, but we are here to enjoy life. And does that mean that there are never rough seasons? No. But it means we can, you know, like we can choose to nevertheless to be grateful and to have fun, because I see often the missing link in life, whether it's in relationships, for health or for success, is fun. And allowing ourselves to be playful and to joke around and to laugh about ourselves and to make mistakes and to not take things so seriously and to dance and, you know, like just to do whatever the F you want.
I know. And here's the thing. I think we need to take life less seriously and take more responsibility. But usually most people take less responsibility and just take life more seriously. It's such a weird where I think like take responsibility for what you're doing, but then have fun with it. And I think that that's just so important. If you're not going to have fun, if you're not going to enjoy this life, at the same time, I do want to say that your relationship to suffering can also change. I remember my therapist telling me, until you see beauty in suffering, you're going to run away from it. And I remember the first time I cried on the floor and went, this is kind of beautiful, was genuinely the day that changed my life. Because for me, it was like, oh no, I see the beauty of my own emotion. I see the beauty of how visceral this is. I see the beauty of my body heaving for air. I feel the warm tears. I see how there is beauty in this suffering, in this moment. And that was life-changing for me. And so I'm not saying look for silver linings and like be super positive all the time, but I think we do need to become more intimate with our suffering and not be so scared of it, but understand that there is meaning and beauty in it and it's going to happen regardless. So you might as well have a healthy relationship to it.
I so feel you. When my grandmother passed away, I was, wow, it just hit me so hard. I was really like broken into 1,000 pieces. And the day when my healing started was when I sat down and allowed myself to feel whatever I felt.
Wow.
And it was, and I was also, you know, like writing a book about it, and it's just, it's a journey. And on some days I was like, wow. Okay. In the morning I was sad, and at lunchtime I was angry, and in the afternoon I was a little frustrated, but I have this sense of happiness inside myself. What is happening? Mm. I got like very confused by that. But then I noticed I have this sense of happiness inside me because I allowed myself to feel it all. And I love to compare it with a rainbow, because what makes the rainbow beautiful? It's the totality of all its colors. And the rainbow holds space, not for its favorite color pink only, but for all the colors, you know? And I think that's how it is for us as well. If we hold space, and of course some emotions are more comfortable than the others, like that will never change. But if we hold space for that, we will also see, wow, I'm grateful that I have someone that I can, you know, miss. And I'm so grateful that I got to experience the most beautiful gift, which is love. And I think when we allow ourselves to feel all of that, it's great. And it's interesting what you said about our association with suffering and our relationship with it can change. I want to touch upon a very interesting topic, because some people are not just scared of sadness and grief and all of, a lot of people are scared of joy and success and love. What do you think why that is, and how can you help people, or what can people help, or how can they help themselves to stop manipulating when things are going well, and just to, rather than like keep closing the doors, but actually open them and say, hey, thank you, life, for sending me these great opportunities.
Yeah. So I think we're scared of success for two primary reasons, or love or joy or these great feelings. One of them is that we're so scared of losing it and how much that's going to hurt. So the higher you climb, the higher the fall, that's a lot of the mentality of like, I don't want to experience what it's like to, this is a stupid example, but fly first class, because then every time I fly economy, I'm going to be really pissed. And I'm going to be like, I am so cramped in here and my back hurts. I'm sitting by the toilets, and like, I get it. And that's kind of how it is, where it's like, if I experience this great love, if I experience this success, what if I do something to lose it? That loss is so scary. And the second reason is because the unfamiliar is scary. You know how to handle your sadness. You know your hacks for the economy class, whatever it is. You know, like, I'm really into this metaphor. You know what to expect. So you're like, why would I put myself in a situation that's completely unknown? I can't control anything, and I don't know if I'll be able to handle. And so there's this fear that prevents us from even trying, and we get so comfortable in the known. And so I think those are primarily two reasons. And what you can do is start to evaluate your beliefs in terms of, do you believe you deserve to succeed? Do you believe you deserve to be happy? Do you deserve to be loved? If you don't think you deserve these things, then you're not gonna be open to them. You're not gonna seek them out. And you're going to assume that even if you get that brief moment of it, you will lose it, because ultimately they will realize that you never belonged with them in the first place, or you never deserved that job in the first place. And so it really boils down to our beliefs, and we need to evaluate them and then reframe them or change them up all completely if they're really negative, before we can probably even be open to life giving us anything positive.
I love that you touched upon the worthiness. I met a few weeks back, I was running into this girl. She's, I would say, like, she was 22. She comes from a big Indian family, moved to the US, had the courage, you know, to try to become an actress. Cool. And things are really aligning for her. And then suddenly she started crying. I'm like, why are you crying? Things are good, right? She said, I'm the first one in my family as a woman to have a degree, to be abroad, and actually to make money.
Wow.
And it just gives me chills because I think a lot of us have this worthiness, not just, you know, like regarding ourselves, but we feel bad when we look back all the generations before us. And it might be very subconsciously that we're like, oh, like I feel bad that my life is so much easier, or I feel bad that I have the money. And especially coming from cultures where there is a lot of poverty, or if when there is a big gap between like being rich and being poor. So I think it's great to work with those beliefs, whether it's with tapping or somatic exercises or therapy, whatever people choose, because we can solve so much, not just for us, but generations before us. And also we load in, you know, like the backpack for all the generations coming afterwards. And I also really liked what you said. People are scared to lose everything. I had that very, very much. I was more scared of success than joy and love. And when I was doing like a long meditation and tapping and somatic exercises and everything, I saw a red bicycle. So when I was 4 years old, I got the most amazing red bicycle from my parents.
Ooh.
And back then we lived in a flat. So there was a basement where a lot of other bicycles were. And I put my bicycle there, and the next day my bicycle was gone. So someone stole it. And it was so ingrained in my subconscious mind, when I love something and when it brings me so much joy, that it can overnight be taken away.
Wow.
And it can, and that's why I love working with somatic exercises and tapping and everything, just to, because sometimes it can be something that we experienced in childhood and it really holds us back. And and another like little example, I just adopted a puppy 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yay, congrats.
Thank you. His name is Felix. But you know how scared I was the day we decided whether we adopt him or not? Because I was scared, how do I live up to being a great dog mom?
Okay.
What Felix really has taught me, besides many other things, is when life presents an opportunity, that opportunity comes with solutions.
Wow, that's powerful.
And that's what you said, you know, like sometimes we're scared, how can we handle first class? You know, but we will, like if someone gives us the first class ticket, we know how to behave, we know which line to take, we like all these things, you know, how to order the food we
sometimes
like.
You ask. I remember being upgraded by accident once in my 20s. Not by accident, anyways, they were being nice. And I literally didn't know how to put down my seat. Like, it was so embarrassing. And I didn't know how to do really basic things. And I was just, like, so humiliated. And it was horrifying. And then someone next to me noticed. And they were so kind. And they were like, oh, this is here. And, like, they explained it in a really non-condescending way. And so you can figure it out. And also, people will help you figure it out. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to do it alone. Ask for help. Like, you know, and it can be as simple as first class, but you know, I still didn't know how to do anything. And I was so self-conscious to order anything. And I was, you know, and I needed those really great people around me to be like, no, do this, eat this. No, actually now you should, you know, and watch this thing. And I absolutely loved it.
And that's what I also meant with, you know, it comes with solutions. It can be whether we get the skills or people that like help us, or we hear a song that has a message or a great book. So I think life really brings along a lot of solutions. And that actually brings me to your book. Your book, It's On Me. It's a profound roadmap to self-discovery. And I'm asking you a probably more uncommon question, but I'm sure you love that. How do you think the animal-human connection helps us when it comes to self-discovery? Or can help us with self-discovery?
Oh my God. Yeah, I absolutely can. I think being responsible for the life of something other than you, I mean, obviously if you're a parent, I understand that's different and there's a lot of that, but I do find that when you are responsible for something, it teaches you a lot about yourself. So Are you putting its needs above your own? Are you really annoyed and can't handle when it's barking if it's a dog and you are trying to? I just think any interaction with the world, and that's how kind of how I finished my book, any interaction with the world tells you a little bit about yourself. And I think having a living, beautiful, wonderful little creature that you're taking care of, it's going to reflect back to you your needs, your wants, your frustrations, your sense of responsibility. And I think it's such a wonderful gift. I don't know if that answers the question. That I've never been asked that in my entire life.
Totally. Do you, I know you're a digital nomad, so you probably don't have a pet, right? Or do you?
I don't. I'm really sad. My sister has a dog who, anytime I'm in Australia, I will try to babysit as much as possible. And to me, actually, this is a fun one. The dog will sometimes know my emotional state before I will. And then I'm offended because I'm like, well, I should know this. I am evolved. And because he's not like a cuddly dog, but when he comes at night and tries to sleep with me, I'm like, oh shit, like what's wrong with my life? And then I'll think of like, yeah, I am incredibly stressed, or yes, like I'm feeling really emotional. And sometimes the puppy, or not a puppy anymore, the dog will actually tell me things before I pick up on it. And I think that that's really fun. And I love him and I want a dog really bad.
It's so beautiful how you described how they know before we are aware of it, because they're so sensitive to emotions and the mental state, and also for pointing things out and to mirroring us. And like to really be like, and one little advice I can give you. So I'm traveling a lot, and that was for a long time now my reason for not getting a dog. But then I was like, actually, why don't I get a small dog? You
I
know,
mean,
something so
that's
obvious.
well, okay. You know what the issue is? That Australia, from my understanding, has really rigorous
Oh, yeah, 10
animal
days
transportation,
quarantine, right?
at least. And so that is, leaving your dog, and
No.
those are really hard trips for the dog, and then they're separated from you. So that's the part that makes me a little sad, and I don't want to put the dog through that, but I'm trying to figure it out because I am so much calmer when I'm around a dog. Like I know that. It's like it soothes my soul. Sometimes I'll have my dog and I'll do a therapy. One time I was dog sitting and my clients were all like, "We'll have a dog, sure." And I was just like petting him while I was having a session. Best sessions of my life. Like it was great.
I love that. Did he get half of the rate that session?
I bought him something really blingy, like a little little new collar,
Sarah, you are a digital nomad. Besides the fact that currently you can't have a dog, but I'm also wondering, how does it impact your concept of home and also your definition of feeling at home?
Oh, heavy question. And something I've grappled with for, I guess a decade that I've been doing this now. And so initially, my answer was always home is where I am. And I think that there's something really beautiful and empowering about that in terms of like feeling at home in myself. And that's still how I feel a lot of the time. However, I think with age and with just being on the road so much, I have started to really appreciate a sense of community. And being on the road can be incredibly isolating. And it's really cool. You meet a lot of people, but these are not, for the most part, super deep relationships. You're so transient that you don't have a routine. And there is something really destabilizing about being on the road all the time. And so for me, although I love it and has been a really important journey in my self-exploration, I am starting to also define home as me and my community. Whatever that is. And I don't think I will ever have one home necessarily in a traditional sense. I mean, no, in a traditional sense, I will, because it'll be in Australia. But I also, have a little sense of home in New York and a little sense of home in certain places in Europe. And that's because I have really close friends there. And so for me, it's just really important to have a couple touch points around the world where I can be seen and be loved and connect with people I genuinely respect and care about, And that's how my definition of home has been kind of evolving over time.
I love, love, love that because most psychologists and psychiatrists always say, home is within me.
Yeah.
And I do,
Amen.
yeah, amen. And I do think it's very important to find a sense of home within yourself. Although I more refer to that, like you don't only need others to fill your cup. That's more what I mean by that. But I do think when it comes to feeling at home, connection is so important. And I totally agree. It's not really the building, but it's people that you are connected with or nature that helps you reconnect with yourself. Somewhere where you feel alive, where you feel safe. And it could be also a little restaurant where you get the dish that your mom is cooking, like whatever it is, but to have those touch points. And I love how you call them touch points, because I think touching is reconnecting, you know, versus disconnecting. So it's really about finding those touch points. And how do you, when you are on the road and you are not in places where you have friends, or if you're at a new place, what helps you to balance out this destabilization?
So a couple things. A lot of times when I part when I travel, I do travel with my partner. So he is a big sense of my home. So that there's something really nice when we are together. And we're not always together. The other things I do is little things that can make a hotel room or an Airbnb or someone else's home feel more like mine. So it's a little candle or it's something I unpack. And I have like certain, I like first thing I come, I like whatever and I unpack because that makes me feel more at home. And I will try to do like certain routines in every place I'm in. Sometimes I'll go and buy a mug I really like. So for example, I'm staying somewhere for like 3 weeks in an Airbnb and I just like don't like anything and that impacts my mental health when I don't like my environment. But let's say the pictures were much cuter than the actual place. I will sometimes go and buy certain things. I'll buy a little mug I like. I will go and buy like a little blanket if it's winter and I'm cold and uncomfortable in the place, just to feel that environmental coziness. And then, I'll try to donate that or whatever once I leave. So for me, it's really environmental in those instances. Like if I don't have people, then what I will focus on will be my immediate environment.
I so feel you. I do the same. Like if I'm at a hotel room, even if I stay for one night, I unpack as much as I can. And also I love to declutter, so I put everything somewhere so I can't see
Me
anything on the
too. Oh
surface.
my gosh, like the throw pillows. I'm
Oh
like,
yeah.
who has touched that? And let's also move
I'm
that out
like,
of the way.
I also make the bed. I know some people laugh at me. I'm like, you're staying at a hotel. But I'm like, yeah, I do this at home. Obviously, it's not as nice as if someone from the hotel does that. But I just
I
keep
love
everything
that.
very neat. And I also, I travel with my tea bags, stuff that I
That's
drink
a
at
great
home.
one.
It's really good. It sounds so simple, but it gives me the sense of home because it's a tea. And I usually have two or three different kinds, and there's one that's chamomile lavender, and it reminds me of my friends because we have it Friday evening when we meet together. So, and candles. So I think it's the little
Candles,
things
yeah.
that
Definitely the
really,
little things.
yeah.
My books, I put them on the nightstand. I don't know. I'm always like my journal, my books. Like I just
I
need
do
to
the
feel
same,
like I,
very nicely aligned.
Exactly. It has to look really cute. That's my vibe.
Oh my God, I love this so much. Sarah, do you where can people find you? Where can they connect with you? I will obviously put everything in the show notes, also your book and your Instagram.
Thanks.
And I think most of our audience is already following you, but just for those who don't follow you yet.
For sure. So I'll list a couple things. Do with it as you may. So I'm most active on Instagram, which is millennial.therapist. I also do write longer form essays, articles on a weekly basis. It's kind of like a blog. It's on Substack. It's called Notes from My Phone. And that's because any thought I have goes into my notes app on my phone. I also just put out a course with Simon Sinek, how to build strong relationships at work. So if you are interested in those work relationships, which can be really important, you can check that out. Book anywhere where books are sold. I think that's, oh, and I will be in Belgrade, Serbia. I'm going to announce this. I'm going to be in Belgrade, Serbia in April, doing a live event and a whole day workshop, which will be in English and then translate it into Serbian. So if you're in the region, come check it out.
That's so exciting. I wish I was there because
I wish
I
you
would
were there
totally come.
too.
That would be
That'd be so fun.
so much fun.
Bring your dog.
Yes. Yeah, we would be sitting in the front row. Be like
I would just be like, yeah, exactly. It'd be great.
my God. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for your time. Not just because I know you're busy and because you have so many great insights, but you are a real human. And I see it with a lot of people who are professionals in the field of psychology and life coaching and everything. They sometimes have the fear of showing their own fears and also their vulnerability. And I think if people see, oh, a psychotherapist also has fears, also has things to work on, also sometimes feels uprooted when she is traveling, it gives them the permission to actually see it's normal and also be humans themselves. So I want to thank you so much for that.
Oh, that's so kind of you to say. And I feel the exact same way about you and your type of hosting. And I think the more we talk about what it means to be human, the more we're giving everyone else permission to be a real human and not be ashamed of what's just inherently us. So thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. It's a wrap for today, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you loved the conversation as much as we did, please share it with your friends and your family and your community and tag both Sarah and us, and we'll see you next Wednesday.